podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
This is the Armchair Cricket Podcast.
Hello all. Welcome to another episode of Armchair Cricket Podcast, a podcast focusing on test cricket by armchair critics of the game. I'm your host, Ajit. In today's episode, we have a special returning guest, Aryan. Hello, Aryan. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Ajit.
Yeah, we were discussing off-air. Been a couple of months, almost close to a year between episodes. I get to read some of your articles that you write for Guerrilla Cricket and other places. But how have you been doing? How are things going as a cricket journalist?
Yeah, so Ajit, currently I am pursuing this as a full-time job. I do not have a press box accreditation, so to say. What I'm doing currently is going to cricket matches, tap on my analytical eye and trying to cover as much cricket as possible. The best part about writing for Guerrilla Cricket is that they offer me a lot of creative freedom. I can leverage that and try and bring as many analytical elements as possible. And the focus has been simple, just to blend the two worlds of storytelling and data-driven work together to form these fascinating features. And I hope you have been able to derive some enjoyment out of my work.
Absolutely. So at least I find your the writing style very entertaining. So I hope you can get more and more opportunities and keep growing. If you were to go into the cricketing games this week, first of all, I think let's start right away with the World Test Championship finalists. It started with India and Australia, the fourth test. Were you, first of all, expecting that the pitch would be a little different for the fourth test? Let's start there.
Yeah, Ajit. So just harking back to the third test, I think I was having a discussion with Kaushik Rangarajan for Cricbuzz. So everyone was surprised with the way India capitulated in the first session at Indore. But if you look back at it, the first two tests went India's way primarily because they made rank turners and the ball was doing a lot. There was variable bounce on offer. And especially from day three onwards or day two evening session onwards, the pitch deteriorated quite a lot. So I think it didn't make sense for India to waver from that set formula, but obviously it backfired in Indore. And Ahmedabad, I mean, after having seen that India's batting order was as susceptible to quality spin and when the ball just turns appreciably, I think India backtracked on that plan and they laid out a pretty sporting track, and that reflected in how the game panned out.
Would you call that a sporting track or just a more sedate track, a very, anodyne track?
Yeah, I mean, there was nothing in it for the spinners, to be honest. And it was pretty docile. But still, it was a slow turner. I mean, it wasn't a pitch where you could hit through the line. Both the batters, Usman Khawaja, Virat Kohli and Shubman Gill also, who ground out centuries, had to like be persistent enough on the crease and be very consistent with your shot selection. It wasn't a pitch which you could term as the best, in my opinion.
So, first of all, Australia took the time. They batted for nearly 2 days, making a big score, almost ensuring there is no way back for India to win the game. So, probably they would be very happy with the returns. So, a big 100 for Khawaja, 100 for Cameron Green, the first of what we hope to be a very promising career. So, for you, surprises that there were no big scores from Smith or Labuschagne?
Yeah, to be honest, they had quite an underwhelming returns the whole series because they are the two most dependable batters Australia have in their lineup. And a lot of the chatter coming into the border government, India are going to keep a tap on Smith and Labuschagne. They had this plan that they were not going to get beaten on the inside edge. They were happy and content being beaten on the outside edge. And I read a Twitter thread today which suggested that Smith played a lot of deliveries in the danger zone, which batters are not advised to in Indian conditions. That is this middle range between back foot and front foot where you are susceptible and vulnerable to playing almost on a half compact front foot stride. So yeah, there were a few dismissals which were soft in nature. like Smith getting out to Mohammad Shami, just getting trapped in the crease and playing off the back foot to a delivery that could have been played on the front foot. And Smith getting bowled to Jadeja, just camping back in the crease again. So I think, yeah, they could have converted those starts. They looked assured for most of the part they were at the crease. Both of them showed good technique against spin as they possess, but it wasn't to be.
And for Green to score his first 100 away from home, does it surprise you at all, or is it just par for the course? It had to happen sometime.
Yeah, it's par for the course. I mean, as Ravichandran Ashwin has said, Green seems to be a once-in-a-generation cricketer. He's got long levers, uses his reach very well in the crease. And similar to how Akshar Patel does it, he has that power game as well and uses the depth of the crease brilliantly. So it was lovely to see him back. He found the right tempo in Ahmedabad. Reiterating the point that you had to find that right tempo when you played in Ahmedabad, because it pitched, we just had to be slightly patient as a batter. You can't go out looking for runs too much because there was this odd ball running a bit on odd ball scooting low, although it was a docile pitch, I know. But still, like all the centuries, we thought there were phases where batters had to really shut shop and just play out some balls. I think even Shubman Gill and Cheteshwar Pujara played out a phase where 96 balls went without a boundary. So that is just indicative of how sometimes batters had to play possum on that sort of a track. And Cameron Green struck that wonderful equilibrium between those two credos. Yeah.
He found the right pace, because at least halfway through that partnership, he was able to accelerate. And Khwaja played the proper anchor role. He sat on the Indians almost and took up, I think, 8 hours of batting. And then made sure, you know, he showed what he's made of, actually. So it was an interesting thing. He himself tweeted saying, never gone away, always here. Not a comeback. Don't call this a comeback. Right. So because he's so sick of people calling his own, his own big scores as always a comeback. He says, I've always been here. Don't call this a comeback. Again, I think somebody who is sort of coming good towards the end of his career, because a lot was always expected of him. And I think an average of 48 as you near the end of the career is not at all bad.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been quite impressed by Usman Khawaja, and especially with the restraint and application he's shown at the crease, because he was typecasted as someone who doesn't really fare well in the subcontinent, didn't get too many chances on the previous two tours. But he's shown everyone how to strike that tempo we're talking about again and again. I think he was disappointed with the sweep shot he played in Indore, because he was really looking set for a daddy 100, and suddenly his innings was cut short by a rash shot, you'd say, because that was the first time he attempted that shot in Indore, and maybe it was not well thought through. It is his shot, it is a part of his armory, but still, considering the game scenario and the way things were poised at that moment, maybe he could have eschewed that. So yeah, he compensated purely for it in the Ahmedabad game. And I think it was largely down to Khwaja's efforts that Australia were able to post such a massive score. Just the time occupation at the crease and the way he went about his business with graceful serenity. It was just like he was an immovable object at the crease.
Absolutely. So that made sure, you know, the other people can accelerate. So even Lyon and Murphy showed it, right? They just refused to give their wickets away, and there were runs to be had. You have to start slow, but then you could pick it up once you got in, right? And they showed it very nicely. So India came into bat with certain amount of pressure on them, but I think they started in the right way. So I was actually expecting Rohit also to get a big one, because he's sort of had a middling series. Are you happy with how Rohit is going? Rohit the player, actually?
Yeah. He's been shaping up well in Test cricket. He's got hundreds in England, and also got a very fighting century against South Africa at home, because I remember that spell, Kagiso Rabada and Arnik Nokia were bowling. I think it was Vizag. And they just really blunted the balls in their opening session. He looked ugly, but he fought it out. And he started the Border Gavaskar Trophy on a promising note, scored a century in Nagpur. But then his returns went on the wing a little, and he mentioned it in the press conference that after the head start he got in the series, he would have looked to capitalize on that, but it couldn't really go that way. And that's exactly what I was talking about in the beginning, that it was that sort of a track Ahmedabad where you were vulnerable to that odd sticking out from the surface or just scooting low and just going through your defenses, because Rohit faced that, right? It wouldn't be called like a goofy shot selection because the ball actually stopped a little on him, and even in the dismissals where you see the back foot going to covers, there's always an element of spongy bounce. So I think Rohit as a whole in this series would be slightly disappointed to not cash in and make it really big, like a really prolific series after the head start in Nagpur. But as a whole, if you see how his intent has been, how he's looked to dominate the opposition, never let them settle into a rhythm, and he's spoken about that throughout. Like, he's always said that there could be different ways you could go about your proactivity business, but it's very important to find that right gear so that you are transferring the pressure back onto such a quality bowling attack like Nathan Lyon, Koonman and Todd Murphy. The latter two, like, taking to international cricket like a duck to water. So you needed to transfer the pressure back. You couldn't be sitting just waiting for the loose balls because there weren't too many on offer.
You're absolutely right. I think they got a lot of praise from their opposition as well, which is a good measure of how much they were respected as the series went on, Murphy and Koonman. And I mean, this is also some joking around, right? So finally, Koonman got a session with Jadeja, but he had to wait till the end of the series, right? And they got into a discussion about how to bowl well on tracks which don't support you much and so on.
Yeah, absolutely, Ajit. I mean, Rahul Dravid has put them in the same bracket as Monty Panesar and Graham Saul. So that's obviously high standards. And even Ashwin in his YouTube channel mentioned that the composure Todd Murphy in particular showed bowling from over the wicket, round the wicket. He's a slightly different fundamental bowler as compared to Nathan Lyon. He relies more on side spin rather than overspin, which is Lyon's way to go. But despite the modus operandi being slightly different, he stuck to his lines, maintained the pressure on the Indian batters. His flatter trajectory actually disallows stepping out of the track a lot, and it was just wonderful to see him bowl, being a rookie in Indian conditions. I think Nathan Lyon, when he came to India, he already had the Sri Lankan tour under his belt. So there was some previous experience, so to say. But in Murphy's case, he was completely raw and fresh. And then to produce a display like this, it's absolutely phenomenal.
No, indeed. He looks like somebody who might be here for the long haul. The GOAT, as they call him, Nathan Lyon, is coming to the end of a storied career. So it might be that he might have enough tests to hand over the mantle to Todd Murphy. Looks like the one that might inherit the mantle.
Yeah, absolutely. And Nathan Lyon has been coming to the end of a decorated career. And it would be great if Todd Murphy and Matthew Koonman, because they have shown the potential, they can take it forward from here. And the ring of the baton can be a smooth transition going forward.
Right. Now, then comes the question. Who will finish with more wickets, do you think? Because even Ashwin is not very far off, probably, from the end. Who will finish with more wickets at the end of their career? Lyon or Ashwin, when it comes to tests?
I think Ashwin would pip Lyon to the post. Because, you know, although, again, as we said, between Murphy and Lyon, they are two fundamentally different bowlers cut from different cloths. Lyon has tremendous belief in his stock ball, doesn't have all the tricks in the trade. But Ashwin is, you know, spin scientist, as they say, and he has all the tricks in the bag, the carom ball, the flipper, the one that comes out of the hand, straight out of the hand, the slider. So he's got that whole repertoire of deliveries. But just the fact that Ashwin plays a lot more in the subcontinent, that gives him an edge in the wickets column. And even his returns recently in overseas games, you see how he performed against Australia in the Border Gavaskar Trophy down under, where he got Smith trapped in the leg slip cordon, and Laushan as well fell prey to him in this series and the previous one. So I think Ashwin in the long run will just have an advantage over Lyon.
Well, let's see if that indeed materializes. We know Ashwin can bat a bit more than Lyon. But also, I think there are enough critics of his when it comes to his performances in the Sena countries. But maybe we'll save that for another episode. But going on, another much-awaited 100, something that's been 3 years in the making, apparently, Virat Kohli. So, does that make you happy as an Indian cricket fan? Finally, Virat Kohli has had this bugbear off his back now.
Yeah, getting that monkey off the back has been huge for Kohli. it has been an enjoyable experience watching that 100. It had threads running from his Cape Town 70 odd, if you remember. He really gritted it out in that innings, and even Dravid mentioned at the end when they had the chat after the Ahmedabad test, because he was out in that South African series like fishing to wide deliveries, which was so out of character for a player as gritty and as dogmatic as Virat Kohli. But he showed signs of that pure gumption and just application at the crease. I think there were phases where he went without a boundary and just built in singles and doubles, used his fitness to the optimum. And it was just a classic test attritional knock. And it was very similar to how Khwaja constructed his innings, because there was restraint in its paramount capacity, because Khwaja cut out the drive for most of his innings by and large, and Virat didn't go for any eight shots, as has always been the hallmark of his test knocks. All the double centuries he's got, he's never really taken the aerial route, and it was just pure classic sweat.
Absolutely. So now I dare say 100 in each format in the international level in about 4 months' time. In about 4 months' period, he's had 400s. Is this a resurgence we'll see, or is this just the candle sort of, as they say, it gets brighter before the end?
No, I think he has plenty of cricket left in him at the moment. Just considering his fitness levels, I think he's very different to someone like Rohit Sharma, because he's really at the top of the league when it comes to like athletic ability. So I hope there's plenty left in the tank. And just considering it from a standpoint of where his runs were hurtful to his own being, like for example, he's talked about how he was not being able to contribute to the best of his ability. When Dravid spoke about how the pressure was growing around when that three-figure mark will come, he had gone almost 1,200 days without a test 100. So Dravid spoke to him about whether it was playing on his mind. But he actually made a very good point that it was never about his own contribution. It was about how much he can bat time, how much he can contribute to the greater good, to the larger scheme of things. And that was making him itch a bit, that he was not being able to harness his potential to the fullest. And once he got into that groove, I think he mentioned specifically that he was feeling in good throughout the series. He was defending spinners very well off the front foot, going back deep in the crease off the back foot. And he was looking in really touch. There were some unlucky dismissals, like strangled down the leg once in a while. And somehow just little errors in judgment of line length. By and large, his innings were really well composed throughout the series. So it was just a very beautiful culmination that he ended the series on a high note. And it was just reiterative of how Kohli has always been like a player, always putting the team ahead of himself. And I just found it very insightful listening from the man himself, that he was actually feeling disappointed that he wasn't able to express himself fully. And now that he's back into his groove, you can expect a lot more from what is clearly a champion cricketer.
Absolutely. I was thinking, if it really doesn't get going well, end of 2023 World Cup, he might take certain decisions, but now maybe a little bit longer. But let's see how far he's able to keep that motivation going and, you know, keep firing along on all cylinders, as we know.
Ajit, just before we move on to the next topic, do you feel there was a pivotal moment in the series where Australia actually squandered advantage? Because in the Delhi test, India was slated to bat last, and Australia had a lovely 60-run lead going on for them with Travis Head coming out all this blazing. And suddenly the way they imploded on the third morning, the first session, a word on that and how that sort of played out as a watershed moment in the series.
Absolutely. Look, that was an indeed important point. Had they come out on that day and done a little bit more, they could have taken the series 2-2, or even they could have taken the series 2-1 maybe, right? India would have, there is a chance India would have gone into the last test under pressure, 2-1 down maybe, correct? All they needed was probably 150 runs and they could have had India really in trouble in that second test. But okay, it was not to be. And for me, it was for the good. I would have been disappointed if India did not make the World Test Championship final, having a series at hand at home. Against, Australia is never an easy competitor, but at home, India would do their best, right? Then I think it was lucky that Australia stumbled a bit on that day and India were able to take the opportunity to first of all, take the series. So the moment the series became 2-0, that means, you know, India will not lose the series and then they could play to their strengths. But, well, they needed one more decision to fall in their way, which it did. So let's quickly go and have a chat on that one. New Zealand did India a favor. So India already knew going into the last day of the series that they had qualified for the World Test Championship. So were you able to catch maybe the highlights of this amazing game between Sri Lanka and New Zealand?
Yeah, I was watching bits and pieces of it on Twitter. But I didn't really tune into the entire game because obviously India and Australia was going on simultaneously. And me being a Indian correspondent for Gorilla Cricket, my role was confined to writing features. So obviously, it is a very creatively demanding process writing a feature from 9 o'clock in the morning to 5:30 in the evening till the session goes on. You are jotting down these notes and then compile it into a very nice feature that makes people read it. So I wasn't able to like pay a lot of attention to it. But yeah, from the looks of it, it was a humdinger and a very thrilling contest.
Well, going into the last day, it was not even sure if, you know, there would be any game because rain started the day and we were all thinking. I watched it for a few minutes and then I thought, oh, this looks like a dead pitch or a dead game, because if the rains took away anything more than the 20 overs or so on the day, there was a high likelihood New Zealand would not have enough time to chase, right? So, yeah. First of all, that went their right way. New Zealand made a right approach. Look, leading up to the last day, if we were to look at it, there were a couple of really impactful innings that already were played. So New Zealand, first of all, Sri Lanka batting first made 355. They would be a bit disappointed. They were solid scores in the top six. Nobody was able to carry on, make a 100 there, right? So Tim Southee showing his class. Also, Tim Southee, the skipper, sort of in the last two tests, having a major comeback. So Tim Southee took a 5-4. Matt Henry took a 4-4. And then when they batted, they were in a lot of trouble. They could have considered a lead of 100 easily. But then Daryl Mitchell hung in there. But with him, the tail, everybody contributed, the last four, five contributed. And mainly Matt Henry making that very useful 50, right? So they sort of even took a lead when most of us thought they're going to concede a 100-run lead. And from that point on, Angelo Matthews scoring 100, showing he still has it in him. Some decent support from the lower middle order and middle order for Sri Lanka. You would be a bit disappointed if you're a Sri Lanka fan. They couldn't cross a lead of 300, but 284 was a very serious chase. Right, this was the highest chase achieved in this ground by New Zealand. But then New Zealand started really slow. Tom Latham, I saw he was 24 and he took 80 balls over it, almost 2 hours. And Kane Williamson himself had a strike rate of about 20 at some point in time when him and Latham were batting. They were actually not thinking of the result far away. I think it was that click when first Henry Nichols started making runs, but then Daryl Mitchell again. What an effort this game from him.
Yes. That is a wonderful explanation of the proceedings. Yeah, so just pinpointing on two things. Kane Williamson has had a lean patch recently. His returns against England were diminishing and he wasn't in a successful phase of mind. So how does he switch that mode and just be a big match player when the team needs him to be? I read an article on Cricket Info today where it was indicated that he takes the power out of those big moments and just plays it very uber cool. Especially in the 2019 World Cup final, also that demeanor of his. So, just a word on that. And secondly, New Zealand had an underwhelming WTC campaign this time. They were the defending champions, but they haven't been able to measure up to the expectations. I presume that you have been following their fortunes. So I would love to hear a word on them.
First of all, they were a little bit in transition. So, indeed, you'd think as the defending world champions from the first time, they would do a bit better. But first of all, if you look at their tests, they started very underwhelmingly. You're absolutely right. They lost Ross Taylor along the way. They lost Trent Bolt along the way. And some of the big names, including Southee, right? And these people would feel a bit, you know, let down that way if you look at it, that they couldn't take New Zealand again to the World Test Championship final. For me, what really hurt New Zealand is some of their losses in 2022 in the Northern Hemisphere. Especially that loss to England, that series loss, where you would expect they would do a bit better, right? And you would also think, you know, they lost test match to Bangladesh at home in 2022 early on. All of these were a bit of a reversal when you think about it. New Zealand, the way I look at it, they don't take series 2-0, 3-0. They would take it 1-0 probably, or 2-1, something like this. It'll always be a well-contested series, but you would expect they would take these tight moments. So they would be a bit disappointed at not being able to do that, especially away. So the New Zealand team that came to the World Test Championship final in the first time had a lot of good results in Asian conditions as well. They did well in Sri Lanka. They did well against Pakistan. They didn't have that this time. So that's where I think a little bit of their results didn't go their way. And their position in the World Test Championship table really does not reflect how well or how badly they have played. It's just that sometimes because of certain key moments not being correctly played or not being capitalized on, I think they ended up at eighth, right? This is the way I look at it. To answer your first question, Kane Williamson, I think this is a class player, right? And he's a member of the Fab Four. I mean, I was only recently joking with somebody that now Kohli has scored runs, Joe Root has found his way back. He's sort of still there or thereabouts. Williamson has also found his way back. It's only now Smith. If Smith had hit 100 in that last test against India, then we would have had the Fab Four back. But, you know, I think you're absolutely right. His attitude, he can basically forget the context. He can just think, this is me. I've been playing for a long time. This is the ball. This is the bowler. I'm going to play the ball, not the bowler. Or I'm going to play the cricket game rather than the situation, which is what happens to most of us. We get into our own heads. We think of the bigger picture. We think on what is happening, what is not happening, and then we make mistakes and we give away our wicket. I think Kane Williamson is completely able to detach himself. This is probably a sign of his greatness. So also, I think for a year or so, I thought he lost a little bit of interest at the highest level. He has a young family at home. There were some troubles. There was knee troubles. This was the most important thing. I think he was not able to trust his fitness for a while there. With his confidence coming back in his fitness, he's able to convert them into scores. You immediately saw two really pivotal hundreds in two important games, both of which New Zealand went on to win. I would dare say, just like how we said about Kohli, Williamson is also back. Probably another year or two of good cricket left.
Yes, Ajit. Definitely. And I think MS Dhoni also tried to inculcate that sort of mindset within India, where the focus would always be on the process, and it would be a very process-oriented, process-driven approach. And they were trying to lessen the heft that India as a cricket-crazy country places on the result.
So, but that's okay. Look, it's completely different, I think, being an Indian cricketer at the highest level. The amount of expectations you carry in, not just expectations, sometimes even the curses you may carry of people who may have narrowly missed out, right? It's quite something. But that doesn't matter, I guess. So you have to really be able to separate the player you are facing and the situation you are forced into, and then you just think that I'm here, I've trained, I'm going to succeed just by, you know, banking on my processes, what you already said.
Correct. And if you look at it, I read a very nice quote in the book by Paddy Upton, the mental conditioning coach. He's written a book called Barefoot Coach. So he advocates that fear of failure and performance pressure are the two single biggest obstacles to high performance sport.
Indeed, indeed. I mean, I can tell you, fear of failure is quite something. If you are able to deal with it, half your battle is already won, right?
Exactly.
The expectation that you bring, sometimes I think that's why Kohli fails in the pivotal games in the finals of limited overs series, especially world stage, simply because of the pressure he puts on himself. It was the same with Tendulkar, I dare say. Even the great Tendulkar may have felt a bit of this. On any other day, he would not care about it. Only in the finals, he almost says, I cannot fail today. Both of these players, right? No, I cannot fail. Today, my team is depending on me. And you would end up failing. You have to just say, I'm going to go and enjoy myself out there. It's fine if I make 20, it's fine if I make 100, right? That's when probably... Yeah. You would probably succeed. If you look at the likes of Rohit Sharma or Sourav Ganguly, probably they are not thinking about the bigger picture at all. They're just there to enjoy themselves. They're just there to, or there may be a battle within a battle, something even slightly that plays on the ego of the player himself. Maybe this bowler got me out last time, I'm not going to give him my wicket, whatever that is, right? And then you just build on that.
Yeah, and we don't have to take our minds too far back down the line, because baseball is testimony of what players can do when unleashed.
Absolutely. Well, at least it's another New Zealander, right? So he always played his entire cricket that way. I think he never took a back step. I remember in the World Cup final of 2015, when they lost to Australia, he came out and there was a very interesting discussion between the Australian keeper and him, where Australian keeper wound him up and then he ended up getting out to Mitchell Stark in the very first over. But that was the talismanic player. If he had gotten off to a start, we knew probably New Zealand stood a chance against that Australian 11, right? So that guy never takes a step back. I think that's how his mentality is. That's how he makes a living. And he's been able to inculcate that, Brendan McCullum, into his players. His wards, he's had a couple of less than successful stints. He's been a coach of Kolkata Knight Riders as well previously, right? So they weren't able to achieve a whole lot, but they once went to final when he was the coach with Owen Morgan, the captain, right? They were able to play that fearless brand of cricket. He's now able to inculcate the same sense into the English national team. And you see people like Johnny Bairstow with the shackles broken, people like Zach Crawley. I was more like talking about Zach Crawley. So these people and Joe Root now sort of trying to find a new position for himself, playing more at ODI manner, right? Sort of almost there was a joke, right, on Twitter. Joe Root is actually auditioning for the One Day World Cup, but he's playing in white for England, right? So moving on. So if you were to now have a quick chat about the South Africa and West Indies test. Well, West Indies would feel really let down by the way they ended that series, because the first test they lost, but they were in the contest throughout. And you thought, you know, chasing 250 on the last innings in the first test, they let themselves down a little bit. But right through the second test, you could see one test was keener to win than the other. One team was keener to win than the other, because batting first, South Africa put a solid foot forward. This was actually a challenging pitch. Huh? It is South Africa didn't make it look like that when their top three or four batted. Themba Bavuma finally made some runs. At least in the first test, first innings, he already made 28, which was a lot more than what he made in the first test. And then their middle order sort of failed. Otherwise, this was a 500 for the taking as far as South Africa was concerned. And West Indies, I think I was sort of mentioning this to someone again. So West Indies seemed to play every test, every away test, as if that's their first away test. So they forget the learnings that they could have taken from their first away test in South Africa or in a practice game. They started the second test as if it was their first game on tour. So, but by the afternoon, they had become better by when sort of South Africa suffered a collapse. So Gudakesh Mothi, he was included. So both teams included spinners. So two spinners each. And then Alzari Joseph did some fast, good, incisive bowling, and that meant South Africa were kept to 320. But then West Indies, see, again, you have it, you have a chance here. If you take a lead of 50 or 60, you know, you can then sort of take a commanding position in the game and maybe put South Africa under pressure. They couldn't do that. So it took Jason Holder and sort of the all-rounders, Roston Chase, Kyle Myers, the keeper, Joshua De Silva. These people scored the runs. The top four were completely missing. Right. This is when the top four had to step up. And with the contribution from the tail, you would have gotten to 450, which would have been fantastic on that pitch. But South Africa also deserve a lot of credit. Bavuma is a great captain for me. He is able to inspire his players to go beyond what they can do and sort of deliver a win. So, and he did that with the bat. So in the second innings, they were in a lot of trouble. So even though they had a decent lead, at 5 for 103, if South Africa had lost control and if they were 150 all out, West Indies would be back in the game, again chasing something around 260 or 270. He stood up, he made his biggest score, second 100, 172, and I was very disappointed he couldn't get to 200. So, I don't know how much of this test you were able to follow.
I wasn't able to keep a tab on the entire series, but I did check out some individual performances and I was quite impressed by how Tony De Zorzi batted. I think the likes of Keegan Peterson and Tony De Zorzi, these guys coming into the scene and the old heads like Themba Bavuma scoring the runs again. I think it just gives the South African fans something of substance to enjoy, especially after the SA T20, the environment in South African cricket in terms of watching cricket and the passion, enthusiasm for the game on the upshot. And the green shoots are finally appearing.
Look, Peterson, yeah, he did good at the start. He couldn't really convert after that. So I'm hoping Tony De Zorzi does better than him, right? Yeah. And he's able to come back and do well and continue to do well. So also away from home, right? In seeming conditions, for example, or in subcontinental conditions. But this guy has a nice temperament. That's what I noticed with Tony DeSarzi. You found that, right? And then in the last innings, look, probably the result was beyond doubt. You can't see this West Indian team chasing 391, but again, complete collapse. At 34 for 6, you didn't have any doubt which way the result was going. I mean, that left me with a lot of pain because I want to see West Indian cricket succeed. I have a lot of liking for the way they play their cricket. But then in the first, let's say 10 overs, the game was finished by the spinner, Simon Harmer and Keshav Maharaj. Keshav Maharaj even got badly injured trying to celebrate because he asked his captain to review and the captain said no probably. But then he convinced his captain to review and it was out indeed. Right? That was the sixth wicket, West Indian wicket to fall and he injured himself. But outside of that, there was not a lot left to write home about at all. From 34 for 6, even without one of their spinners, even without one of their other bowlers, they were simply able to go on and finish the game off. So that for me filled me as a test match fan with a lot of disappointment, the way West Indians played. Because I remember in our last episode, I even said maybe West Indies can draw the series 1-1 if they're able to, you know, hold their head.
Yeah.
They completely lost that. So this was sort of on the bylines. The main series we were watching was New Zealand, Sri Lanka and India, Australia, of course. Now that the finalists are decided, before we go away from this test match discussions, whom do you think will win the World Test Championship this time?
I think India has a very good chance of winning because they have been performing overseas well in recent times. And the biggest reason for that overhaul has been the contributions of the top order batters. Like we've seen the likes of KL Rahul and Rohit Sharma score those runs in the English conditions, which has always been a bugbear of the Indian batters. Like we've never really gotten off to blazing starts in the test in England. So it's just that box being ticked is a very positive sign. And I don't know how much Bumrah's absence will impact because it is obviously be a huge factor. But then he's been out of action for quite a while now, and Siraj, Mohammad Shami, even Umesh Yadav in Indian conditions as his role as a workhorse, they've been doing exceedingly well, and India can rely on the supporting people to, like, have a good account of themselves. Going back to the Keshav Maharaj incident, yeah, you mentioned it. It was an addition to the long list of injuries we've witnessed in recent times. I mean, Johnny Bairstow injuring himself on the golf course, and right. Glenn Maxwell running around
on the
basketball court. Friend's birthday party. I think, yeah. And Keshav Maharaj obviously injuring himself while the wicket celebration. He's also ruled out of the next stint, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, he had a county stint lined up as well. We don't know if he'll be fit enough to make the county stint. It's a long injury, so it might take him 6 to 8 weeks, they're saying. And the England county scene starts not long from now. So it's unfortunate, but we really hope, you know, these freak injuries stop. So weird freak injuries that are, you know, taking months and months. Bumrah himself, that's more stress related, but he's injured out of. Shreyas Iyer had an injury in the last second test. He couldn't come out to bat. So plenty of these things going around. Let's hope, you know, it's probably players pushing themselves a little bit more during training, but that's the way it is played. You have to be at 110% while you're on the field and there's no excuse you're not. So sometimes it may result in some injuries. But okay. Now, that was one of the questions I had to ask you. The other one, India are actually appealing ICC's decision about the Indore pitch. Do you see any merit for that?
So the reason they have heard is that the third umpire actually was hasty in his decision to rate it poor because generally, the ICC takes a bit of time under these matters. They like give it a thorough consideration. I think it was a little rough because the third umpire's verdict was based largely on how the first session played out. Like there was a little bit of moisture in the pitch and India just imploded. So it made it look a lot worse than it actually was. Because if you follow the trajectory of the game after that, the batting conditions were not too threatened. I mean, the odd ball was turning and it was zipping sharply up the track. But batters who stood their ground and were able to show some application were able to score well. I mean, Khwaja got a lovely 70 and he was able to bat positively. Peter Hanscom got runs, I think. So, I think it was a slightly rushed decision and there were fair grounds of appealing that.
Let's see. So, look, there was earlier a Pakistan test, which I think produced 17 or 18 wickets in 5 days before, 4 days before England somehow bass balled a victory, right? That pitch was rated poor. I don't know which is worse. So for me, yeah, indeed, lack of application, lack of dead batting. I mean, nobody played out a day for 160, right? No team. You can't see teams doing that, but probably that's what was required on a pitch like that. So you can't completely say the pitch was blameless, but then there is something about the techniques of the players as well.
Yeah. And also, Ajit, one of the questions that was lingering in my mind was, you remember the fifth test that was rescheduled, the India versus England last one-off game that was played in isolation. England really came out hard. They were just getting started with the baseball doctrine. And India looked listless in that test. They had no answers. They were devoid of ideas on how to control this rampage. So considering that Australia also have that firepower in terms of Travis Head, and Manus Lavushan can also play that proactive game. He can be very enterprising when it comes to transferring the pressure onto the spinners. And Smith can, obviously play at that slightly enterprising tempo. So do you think if Australia actually plucked a leaf out of England's book and, just up the ante a bit, could India come under the fire?
I dare say Australia will be favourites while playing in England simply because they have had better results there. India really depends on the kind of preparation they're able to get in place, because India are not good travelers, and the first test or the first game that they would get to play would never be their best preparation and best result. So if they're coming out of an IPL and if they're going there, because it's in June, it's the first week of June, right? So it's going to be a bit tough, I would say, for India, but they're also consummate professionals. So I expect Australia might start favourites, but India will definitely have something to say about it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And while we are at it, Akash Chopra broached the idea that because WBC is played out over a period of 2 years, it is slightly unfair to adjudge the winner by just a one-off game. As you rightly mentioned, the preparation time plays a crucial factor. And I think at this point, it is quite neck-to-neck because the IPL will be concluding and India would be travelling. So they've already sent those due balls to the IPL bowlers and they'll be practicing in the various franchise sessions. But still, do you think having a three-test series as the WTC final makes more sense?
I guess so, but will teams be able to make that time in their calendar? Well, for the next World Test Championship final or even two Test Championships finals down the line, probably if you plan it in, that's possible. That's the only way. But then the question is, do all teams make that window free? That's the toughest part, including England or wherever you want to host the final. Let's say next one, it's going to be hosted in, given the places where it can be hosted, you can't host it in subcontinent. It'll be too warm, right? So it'll have to be England. Or you say we host it, next one will be hosted in the Southern Hemisphere. Then it'll have to be the December to February window. So for a three test series, you'll need at least 3 weeks, right? If not a little bit more, 4 weeks maybe. Then would all the teams set aside this, be able to do it? Because you don't know who's going to reach the finals. This is the only problem that we have to tackle. And I guess I would like it if it's a series. But is it really realistically possible? I don't know. it remains to be answered. But it might be possible that something may have to be rearranged then. That might still be doable, right?
I've been reading a lot of Jason Holder interviews recently, and he always makes a lot of sense, and he comes across as a person who really understands the international scheduling and the treadmill of international cricket. So he also said that because West Indies plays a lot less number of games as compared to the powerhouses, they are not able to replicate the sort of style that England or Australia some occasions follow, that ultra-positive game and that brand of cricket. So your take on that, how have Bangladesh, West Indies, people who are at the bottom of the ladder, the teams who are on the fringes, how they can sort of amp it up and level the playing field when it comes to performances in the WTC campaign? Because currently, it's just like a 3-horse, 4-horse race.
Look, it's very simple, right? New Zealand, you may say nobody expected New Zealand would have come to the finals. Rather, only they were coming to the final, they won it, right? So it's about consistency, both home and away. So when you look at New Zealand, I told you the first time they had good results in Asia, which is completely alien to them, right? So then when it comes to West Indies, we were just discussing that they were unable to put their best foot forward even in helpful conditions that were helpful for their fast bowlers. right? So it's about being able to convert something that you see as a potential advantage into a result. And that can only mostly happen when you're touring away. So the first thing, most teams are very strong at home when it comes to test matches. They can prepare the pitch and keep the conditions in a way that suits them. This is okay. But then you still have to win, right? That's the first thing. Nothing is a given. Next thing, you need to have at least two or three results while traveling in those 2 years period, which would be a little surprising to start off with. So you start well, first of all, to try and if you have home series, you try to convert them into wins, series wins. So I don't think you need big wins. I don't think you need 3-0, 4-0 wins. That will definitely help in terms of points. But if you consistently do a 1-0 and a 1-all, you might be there or thereabouts come 6 months left for the World Test Championship final. That's the way to go about it, I would think.
Yeah.
All right. Now, just a quick word on this England-Bangladesh T20A series. So, you know, England won the first two games of the tour, limited overs tour, that is. So they took the ODI series, but then they lost the next four games in a row. So, you know, off air, you were mentioning to me, Bangladesh might finally have turned the corner in their approach to T20As. So would you like to elucidate a bit more on that?
Yeah, because Sridhar and Sriram has been associated with them as a assistant coach, and he always wanted Bangladesh to unearth their potential and play this aggressive brand of cricket where they are able to impose themselves on the opposition and not be really timid in their approach where they are just staying behind the eight ball and playing waiting game. So I think Bangladesh were able to dictate terms a lot in the T20I series because obviously after being 2-0 in supposedly a six-game tour, they were able to turn a corner, as you said, and they were able to put such a quality T20 side, they are obviously the World Cup champions, to put them under the sword. It was a commendable effort. And it was just really enjoyable to follow that series because Gorilla Cricket, as you know, being based out of London, I do have to like keep churning out new stories about Bangladesh in England and whatever series England is involved on. So I think it was a very hard-fought tested series. And I loved the way how Bangladesh were able to come on top.
Indeed. Look, first of all, the pitches were not that conducive. You would not think of these pitches as like the IPL pitches where 200 plays, 195 or whatever. Yeah. So there was some assistance to the bowlers, be it to the spin bowlers. But then you have to also give credit to the way Bangladeshi fast bowlers bowled. Tashkeen Ahmad was really good. Mustafizur Rahman really good in the second of those games where it was actually bowler dominated. But then one guy, Mehdi Hasan Miraz, he did enough. He took four wickets for just 12. But then he also made a crucial 20 in the middle order, right? So it was going to be a close game, but that innings of his where he hit two sixes made sure Bangladesh did not have to worry about how to go about winning the game. So that was a one-man performance. But in the third one, you saw finally Bangladesh sort of coming into their own, putting a good total. I think in these pitches, 140 is already a very, very competitive total because there is some assistance for the slower bowlers and the pitch gets slower as you play on. So the second game was played in Chittagong, the third one in Mirpur, which was again a tired pitch. It was a used pitch. So you knew on this pitch, even 130, 135 could be a strong target. They made 158, which I think was about 15 runs above par. And then England, look, they had a platform set up beautifully by Malan and Butler, right? In these days, expecting to score 60 off the last seven and a half overs in a T20 with about six wickets in hand is pretty much on par. From that point on, England simply imploded. Nobody scored. So, first of all, Malan got out and then Josh Butler followed him immediately, which was a blow. And then they could not cope up with the pressure of the mounting run rate. Ben Duckett, underwhelming series in T20As. Moeen Ali, I was pretty much disappointed with his performances in in the T20As, both with the bat and the ball.
Yes, of course. If you look at it from a grander perspective, the resurgence of Bangladesh batting and the removal of coyness from their approach is very similar to how Zimbabwe went about their business before they secured qualification for the T20 World Cup. So Dave Hughton and Lance Klusener, they played a pivotal role in bringing about that mind shift in how you can just be expressive on the field and go about firing on all cylinders rather than just playing dead.
Right. Well, look, it's about being strong, but being aware of your strength and using it. As I told you, converting some potential into result, actual result. That takes a certain amount of strength in the mind and certain amount of probably not overthinking things. Just go out there and do it. That's it, right? Yeah. And probably Dave Horton, who's been quite a lot around the block. He's gone many times around the block, I must say. He probably knows how to get the best out of his own wards. Especially he knows the culture. He's also Zimbabwean, right? That helps. And Lance Klusener, well, he's a champion cricketer. And anybody who could perform under pressure, it was Lance Klusener, right? If you remember. So I think he's able to bring that attitude to Zimbabwe. Similarly, Sridharan Sriraman, he's worked with teams across the world in Australia and Bangladesh. He has this unique mindset as well. He himself was a very good cricketer. So you see that, you know, you're able to then bring that nous you have and the things you have learned by watching and sort of looking at how champions prepare and perform. You're able to bring that attitude and the team can benefit from that. Now, moving on, if you were to take a look at some of the stories from off the cricketing field. First of all, WPL, it's not really off the cricketing field, but it looks like a two-horse race for now. Because when you look at the table, there are two teams, one that has won 5 out of 5, one that has won 4 out of 5. And when you look at the other three, one has 2 wins, the other two have one win each. I mean, I dare say today looks like the Giants will win. Because it's going to be a very tight game. Delhi Capitals need 13 of 12, but they have 1 wicket in hand. So Giants may win this. So do you see this as just as a two-horse race now, Mumbai and Delhi? Or do you see maybe RCB, who won their first game after a long time, and maybe UP Warriors being able to challenge these two teams?
No, not really. I think Mumbai and Delhi have branched into the ascendancy far away. They are miles ahead in the contest, and it would be very difficult for the other teams to catch up. I mean, it's been slightly jarring to watch as a viewer how there's been a gulf in the terms of competition, how RCB haven't really been able to challenge their adversaries. Their fortunes have been resembling the men's team, how RCB go into the IPL. So, yeah. But maybe this is the first edition, the inaugural cup. Mm. And teams are just getting to know each other. Everyone's just trying to find out the right permutations, the combinations. T20 is a very mechanical and dynamic game. Things can really turn on their head in just a span of a couple of balls. Mm. So, I think things take a little time to settle. And maybe Mumbai Indians are being pushed through by their star power. And slowly and steadily, other teams might be able to click in unison and then perform better as a well-oiled functioning unit.
Let's hope so. They'll need that. And let's hope they're able to come good. At least make a few good performances, come up with a few good performances for their fans and let the results fall as they may. But for now, I see only a Mumbai-Delhi finals. And if I were to ask you who would win, gut instinct answer?
I think Mumbai Indians. They clearly look the front runner. Mm.
Yeah, I think so. I agree with you there. But I wouldn't write UP Warriors off if Alyssa Healy and a couple of their stalwarts can come good. You know, maybe we may see some upsets. But all right, moving on. David Saker has chosen to come back as the England bowling coach. He was one of those people who probably inspired that bowling-related renaissance that England went through around 2010, 2009, 2009. He was the bowling coach at that point in time. So he's come back to assist England in their preparations for the Ashes. So a lot to look forward to if you're an English fan. An Ashes here at home, right?
Yeah, and Ajit, a very interesting piece of news I came across recently. So England, as you know, they've been at the vanguard of technical innovation. They've always been the first to use data and optimize it. So in the county circuit, they're actually giving the umpires a camera around their waist to which actually calculate the trajectory of the balls, how the release points are, and what is the speed of the bowlers. So having all that data set from the county cricket will help the national selectors make better decisions when it comes to which bowler will be the better fit in a given particular set of circumstances. Because in the Ed Smith-led selection panel, data was the crux of their decisions. And I read a book by Ed Smith called Making Decisions. And then he offered a very interesting perspective of how Sam Curran actually operates as a swarm harmonizer. Swarm harmonizer is where a person, just by being themselves, actually enhances the overall capability of a group. So both the averages of James Anderson and Stewart, they average around 25, 26. But their averages, test bowling averages, dropped to 18 and 19 when they are bowling alongside Karan tandem. So it was just a wonderful concept about the depth of their thinking and the analytical approach to it. And I'm really looking forward to how David Sehgal can actually have a say in the whole selection process. And England fast bowling prospects, their spin bowling in Jack Leach, although they're struggling to find a good complementary bowler to him because they've tried around the likes of Dom Bess and also Joe Denley bowled the leg spin bit, but haven't really been able to nail that down. So maybe they can have a good bowler providing able support to Jack Leach.
Well, Rehan Ahmed has been putting in the work. He's too young yet, but who knows? Maybe he's the guy. At least not in the longer format, but in the shorter format, you may see him. Dom Bess may come back into the picture for the longer format. Let's see how things go. Now, the other piece of news: Stephen Smith will be captaining Australia in the ODI series against India. It looks like Australia have had a lot of captains over the past. I think India went through this phase for a while with injuries and people opting out and so on. So now it looks like Pat Cummins will stay home. So it was initially Aaron Finch, then Josh Hazlewood did it for a couple of games. Then this guy comes, Cummins did it. Then suddenly Smith comes in. So a lot of changes. But Smith, the captain, seems to have galvanized that team. They finished better in the second half of the Border Gavaskar Trophy. So maybe a lot to look forward to if you're an Australia fan with Smith captaining the ODI team.
Yes, absolutely, Ajit. Actually, I was supposed to travel to Ahmedabad to watch the fourth test, but then the Dharamshala test got shifted to Indore, and I live
Ah,
very close by to Indore. So
wow.
yeah, I was at the venue. I was at the venue for the third test in Indore. It got over in the blink of an eye. It's not ideal from fans' point of view, but I was mesmerized looking at Smith and how he went about his captaincy business, like taking over the reins from Pat Cummins, who obviously was attending to his ill mother in Australia. And just the tinkering with the field placements, the minute adjustments, the bowling changes, how he kept shuffling the bowlers, how he kept the mesh always on their toes, and just the gesticulation he would make to a bowler for warming up, and just the little things, if you paid close attention to it, it was really a treat to watch as a cricket analyst.
Of course, I mean, with all his tics, I think you cannot take eyes off him wherever he is, whatever he's doing. But you cannot forget that this is a very, very intelligent cricketer, very evolved cricketer. The way he bats, the way he comes up with how to control the things around him when he's batting or fielding. I think he, of course, it goes without saying he's also a fantastic captain. A couple of quick news about Pakistan. So first of all, Pakistan also held a women's exhibition league where two teams played each other. And that was very interesting at the same time when PSL was held, so that maybe we are also gearing up for a women's PSL shortly. So this is excellent news if you are a women's cricket fan. So let's hope this comes through. In another news, Pakistan have made some big changes. So they have rested what you would consider four or five definite starters in the series against Afghanistan because taking into account the workload of their players, so especially Babar Azam, Mohammad Rizwan, Shaheen Shah-Afridi, and Fakhar Zaman, as well as Haris Rauf. All of them have been rested in the T20s against Afghanistan. So you'll have Shadab Khan leading. You'll have Saim Ayub and Ihsanullah, who are breakouts in this year's PSL in the team. And of course, Imad Wasim has been recalled as well. So to ask you a blunt question, would this give Afghanistan a decent chance of winning a series in Pakistan, do you think?
Yeah, actually, you could say that because obviously, when you're shorn of star power team and so many experienced campaigners are suddenly put to the wayside, it obviously opens up an avenue for an opposition team to capitalize. And Afghanistan have shown glimpses of potential because I remember one of tests they played against India as well. There were some decent performances there. And they have a tendency to punch above their weight. So, yeah, obviously, it wouldn't be wrong to say that they could latch on to that.
All right. And most Afghani players are playing in PSL currently, so they know the conditions very well, if they were alien at all to begin with, right? So let's see.
Valid point, yeah.
So the last point is something that happened just moments ago. So it's the game between UAE and Nepal. So in this case, Nepal having won against UAE have actually sealed a spot in the ODI World Cup qualifier. So basically what this means is Nepal will go ahead of UAE and play in the 2023 World Cup qualifier to be held in Zimbabwe. But UAE will have to go
Okay.
through two rounds. One, they have to play in Namibia, and if they make it through, they'll go to Zimbabwe. Right? So this was sort of a little bit of an upset if you have been following the League Two cricket And Nepal have suddenly stormed back out of nowhere to take the fifth place in the qualifiers. So the other thing in this game, the UAE-Nepal game to be held today in Kirtipur, one of the UAE players, Asif Khan, made a one-day 100 of just 41 balls. The tournament has been played where the pitches are a little bit low and slow and they're supporting the bowlers. So a score of 230 or 240 is a decent score on that pitch. Suddenly UAE made 310 thanks to this guy coming in. He came in at the 38th over, and from that point on, he went on to make 100, very much like what AB de Villiers did when he scored the fastest 100 ever in ODIs, right? He took 41 balls for 100. He hit 11 sixers, apparently. I was not lucky enough to witness it. I only saw it later. But then Nepal, whom you never write off, this is the first thing we realize. I'm really looking forward to Nepal one day being considered a superpower of cricket in Asia, because you never write this team off. The day is coming very soon, by the way, because they started a bit weakly. So they were 3 for 37. But then their middle order fought back. So they had a 3 consecutive 50s and the opener made a 50. And they were 269 for 6 in 44 overs when rain intervened. And at that point in time, they were 9 runs ahead on Duckworth Lewis Stern. So they won the game, right? So multiple times in the recent past, we have seen Nepal being rescued by their tail. So I think if you're a Nepal cricket fan, you have plenty to look forward to.
Considering how saturated top-tier international cricket is, I do not have the bandwidth to keep an eye on associate cricket and their progress, their games. But it has been really heartening to see and keep abreast with developments over Twitter. And today itself, the game you're mentioning, I saw some images on Twitter of how jam-packed the stadium was. And it just goes to show how passionate people are about their teams and how cricket is really flourishing in these less-known entities. And it's just good for the greater globality of the game, because we have seen some performances where the teams who were not primed to be favorites, they have created upsets. For example, Netherlands beating South Africa and eliminating them from the competition. So yeah, it's a healthy proposition for the world game.
Absolutely. All right. Those are all the news that we wanted to discuss in today's episode. Thank you very much once again, Aryan, for agreeing to do a guest spot on our podcast. And it's always been a pleasure to talk to you. And I hope we can also host you again for a couple of upcoming episodes sometime in the future. But thanks once again.
Thank you so much, Ajit. Always a privilege talking to you and hearing you go about the international game. Your insights are really germane to the topic. And it's an absolutely great learning experience just speaking to you over the game.
Well, I think you're very free with your praise, but thank you. If I can give you something that you've not heard before, I'm very happy to do that. So, would you like to plug in something? Would you like to plug about some work you do apart from Guerrilla Cricket, any other blog articles you write and so on?
I have had some conversations with senior cricket journalists and they have warned me against overdependence on a single income skill, which currently is writing. So, recently I have ventured into podcasting as well. I've teamed up with a guy from US, Rupayan Samanta, a person from Pakistan. He's a Karachi-based sports journalist called Daniel Shah. We've been inviting some guests over the podcast. So it's called Cricket Beyond Borders. And I would just like to plug that in. If people find
perfect
that interesting, that would be lovely.
Let me look it up. I'll probably put a link of that in the notes for our listeners if they want to get in touch with you. And hope they can also listen to your podcast and grow it. And bless you the same way they have blessed us. We wish all our listeners a good day wherever they may be listening from. Thank you once again for your patronage. Goodbye.
This is the Armchair Cricket Podcast.